Welcome to Brewing One Ear and Out the Other. I'm Pranav, and our guest on today's podcast episode is Dr. Kevin Williams. He's the Chief Medical Officer of Rare Diseases at Pfizer Biopharmaceuticals. Dr. Williams opens up about growing up black and gay in Louisiana during the early 1960s and 70s. After providing a primer about rare diseases, Dr. Williams explains why and how he ended up working at a biopharmaceutical company, in spite of public perceptions. So without further ado, here is our interview.
Hi, Dr. Williams. Thank you for joining us on Brewing One Ear and Out the Other.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So because this is a UCLA-themed podcast, one of the things that we like to do is ask one of the questions that current applicants have to answer as part of the application process. And as always, we think it'll serve as a great introduction for our listeners.
Okay.
And so the prompt we've chosen for you today is, describe the most significant challenge you have faced and the steps you have taken to overcome this challenge. How has this challenge affected your academic or professional achievement?
First, once again, let me just say thank you for the opportunity to speak with you guys today. Hopefully, what I will share about my personal and professional journey will be interesting to your listeners. You're thinking about a challenge. I mean, I'm not trying to be provocative right out the gate, but I mean, I guess I would say that probably the most significant challenge that I've had to deal with or overcome was growing up black and gay in Louisiana in the 1960s and 1970s. It's definitely a challenging time. And, you know, I didn't have, I would say, a lot of positive role models on, you know, certainly not visible on TV or, you know, anywhere, either black or gay. And it was somewhat isolating. I spent years from sixth grade on in predominantly white private schools. And so most of my friends were white. And that presented, you know, some unique challenges because, you know, I felt integrated with them at school and after school. I mean, they went off and did their thing and I went off and did my thing. And, you know, so it was a very kind of disconnected childhood in some ways. Also, being gay was very much isolating in the context of all that. And to overcome it, I mean, I guess I would say that, you know, my parents instilled in me a strong sense of self and of, you know, being the best that I could be and being who I am. And, you know, despite the lack of positive images in front of me, or maybe because of the lack of positive images in front of me, I kind of had this need or desire to prove everybody wrong, at least in my mind. That's kind of how I approached it, I guess.
You talked a little bit about how you had to chart your own course growing up early on. These days, a lot of role models like to exemplify, if you can see it, you can be it, in the sense that when they're leaders, they embody a sense of authentic leadership. They know there are people looking up to them as role models. Maybe if you can talk about growing up early on, how you had to chart your own course, and now that you're a leader, if we look at Black men and women in the executive team members of Fortune 500 companies, it's only 4.5%. As a Black man in the executive suite, do you see any hidden burdens or responsibilities now as a role model?
So I did feel the need to kind of chart my own course through school. And fortunately, I guess, like, I was relatively intelligent and I did well in class. And you really led the way in many of my classes. And I think my classmates, who were just as not used to seeing a Black person in class with them as I was not used to being in classes with white people. I mean, I think it was very interesting for them also, and then to maybe break some of their stereotypes, because I was often first in the class, and they would look to me to raise my hand to answer questions. And so I feel like, I kind of led the way a lot during, certainly during my, high school and elementary school years. And in terms of, now being kind of a more senior leader position at Pfizer, I mean, I think there certainly is a, I don't want to call it a burden, but whether it's fair or not, or true or not, I mean, there certainly is a pressure that I think someone like myself and others in my position probably put on ourselves to be exemplary. There's this sense that, at least that I have, that I can't be mediocre or average, that I really have to excel because others are looking at me and I'm kind of setting the way for others, to come after me. And so there is a little bit of a sense of, that I need to make sure I do this right.
So would you say then, maybe growing up or potentially even now, that there are certain characteristics or traits that you worry about and that you have to act like you're sometimes a different person? Growing up, I know you talked about, you're always top of the class and you have to excel. Are there other things that you were, worried about that made you stand out? And so you were trying to kind of embody maybe whiteness or other characteristics that you thought would like help your career grow?
I think I always felt the need to fit in. And whether that was either academically or by being a nice person, not rocking the boat, not giving people a reason to pigeonhole me into a category or to a stereotype that in my mind maybe I thought they would apply to me, and I don't know if they would or wouldn't have, but certainly in my mind, I was trying to avoid being pigeonholed in a way that I felt other people in my situation, other African Americans, were probably pigeonholed. So yeah, I mean, I think maybe I was, nicer, more congenial, tried to fit in, tried to, make sure that I was liked, maybe more so than others might have felt the need to do in that situation.
So let's talk a little bit about your current work at Pfizer. And before we do, we want to thank your colleagues at Pfizer for helping to create this vaccine that I think was the first one to get approved and has really made a huge difference in the COVID pandemic. So thank you to your colleagues. So you currently serve as the Chief Medical Officer of Rare Disease at Pfizer Biopharmaceuticals Group. Can you tell us a little bit about what your work entails and maybe start with what a rare disease is?
Sure. So a rare disease, there's really not a standard definition worldwide. I mean, in the United States, a rare disease is defined as a disease with a prevalence of less than 200,000 in the population. Around the world, I mean, you'll see varying definitions. Most of them would probably range from 40 to 50 cases per 100,000 people. So definitely diseases that are uncommon. And they span the gamut across therapeutic areas. I mean, they can be in any system in the body. And there are over 7,000 rare diseases that have been described. And as you can imagine, it would be impossible for a pharmaceutical company to focus on 7,000 diseases. So within Pfizer, rare disease, our focus is in four major categories. And hematologic disorders, benign hematologic disorders. So diseases like hemophilia or sickle cell disease, which in sub-Saharan Africa is not a rare disease, but in the United States, it is a rare disease. Diseases of endocrine or inborn errors of metabolism origin. So diseases like growth hormone deficiency, acromegaly, Gaucher's disease, neurologic disorders like Duchenne's muscular dystrophy or Friedreich's ataxia, and then rare cardiology diseases. So those are kind of the four areas in which we as a pharmaceutical company have tried to boil the ocean of rare diseases and narrow our focus into diseases where we felt we had the skills and capabilities and substrate to be successful. In terms of my job, I'm the, as you mentioned, the chief medical officer of our rare disease organization. And in that role, so I've been in this role for 5 years now. And in that role, I have about 200 medical colleagues in North America, Europe, parts of Asia, who are all medically trained or science-based colleagues. So medical physicians, PharmDs, PhDs, and their job is really to provide medical leadership for our inline portfolio. So the marketed medicines that we have in those disease areas that I had mentioned, and really to focus on generating additional data post-approval once the drug is on the market and communicating that data, providing physicians, providers with the information that they need in order to know how to use our medicines safely and appropriately in their patient populations. I mean, so that's really kind of what my organization does. We also support the work that our research and clinical development colleagues are doing with the pipeline portfolio and bringing new medicines forward through the study process up through registration and approval.
How does a pharmaceutical company, particularly one like Pfizer, that's worth hundreds of billions of dollars, balance a pipeline of these mass market drugs versus drugs for a very small subset of the population? And then when you're looking at that small subset of the population, why do you feel like it's important to continue to treat or find cures for these rare diseases?
In the United States, it's less than 200,000 is considered a rare disease. It doesn't vary as the population varies. The population doesn't vary that much. I mean, from decade to decade, but it's less than 200,000 is the definition in the U.S. And again, as I said, worldwide, they often will divide it in per X numbers or per 100,000 or per 10,000. It's a challenge, right, to balance between drugs that are for more of a primary care population, diseases, such as hypertension or heart disease or diabetes, against rare disease drugs. And part of it, I think, comes from understanding that no matter where you are and whether it's a primary care area or a specialty area, that there is a tremendous unmet medical need. And so Pfizer, I think we start with our vision, and our vision is really to bring to market breakthroughs that change patients' lives. I mean, that's what our focus is on. And so we have structured the company in a way to help facilitate that. So the way that Pfizer is structured, there's a commercial organization that is focused into six innovative business units. One of those is rare disease. One is internal medicine, which is more primary care type medicines. One is around vaccines, which was the business that brought the COVID vaccine to market. There's an oncology business, inflammation and immunology business that is focused mainly on rheumatologic disorders such as rheumatoid arthritis, or atopic dermatitis, those types of things. And then a hospital business that's focused on sterile injectables and anti-infectives. So each of those businesses kind of operates as its own independent business within the broader enterprise. And the broader enterprise then can serve an analogy would be as kind of a venture capitalist, right? And look across those six businesses and see where it wants to invest its money and which of the projects or initiatives or compounds that are in development is likely to achieve that right balance of bringing value, the most value to patients, as well as to Pfizer. So, we don't always get the balance right, but I think that's how we try to make sure that we are balancing the needs across the various areas in which we're involved and trying to bring medicines that are really going to make a difference in patients' lives. It's important to be involved in rare disease, I think specifically, because there's a huge, huge unmet need in this area. One of the things that we often say when we talk to people about rare diseases is that there are 350 million people worldwide living with a rare disease. So a number of people that's larger than the population of the United States. So while rare diseases are individually rare, they are collectively common. And so there is a huge unmet medical need that we need to focus on and to address and to make sure that these treatments are made available to patients.
So approximately 95% of rare diseases don't have approved treatments. How is Pfizer fostering more options for these rare conditions?
So your stat is spot on. Only 5% of rare diseases have treatments available to them, which is a sobering statistic. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this area to bring more treatments to patients who really are in need of medicines and therapies that can help them address the challenges that they're dealing with on a daily basis. There are a number of things that I think can be done and that have already been done to try to support and expedite the development of medicines for rare diseases. I mean, there's the Orphan Drug Act, and there's orphan drug exclusivity to kind of encourage drug manufacturers to focus on bringing drugs to market. I mean, there are financial incentives that you can put in place and haven't put in place to help support the development of rare disease medicines. I mean, there's also things that can be done on the development and approval pathway that could help bring these medicines to market. So focusing on innovative ways of clinical trial design, so not having to go through the typical kind of phase one, phase two, phase three approach, with increasingly large populations of patients testing the drug to make sure that, it's safe and effective for the use that it is intended. Finding ways to do that in a more expedited way in smaller populations is critical because you don't always have the numbers of patients that you would have in a primary care population when you're trying to test a drug. So identifying the patients, getting them enrolled in trials, understanding the epidemiology of the disease to really understand what are the right endpoints that you want to follow in order to ensure that you are addressing that the medicine that you're trying to bring to market is addressing the disease and making a difference. And all those things are challenges. And so thinking about innovative ways of clinical trial design so that we're not taking a square peg and trying to fit it in a round hole, right? Trying to use clinical trial designs that have been used for decades to bring primary care medicines to market. And then just kind of taking those and transplanting them into rare disease areas where they may not be as may not fit as well. And then finally, I think there are ways that you can expedite the regulatory process, without taking shortcuts. And I know that was a concern that people talked about during the whole development of the COVID vaccine. But there are ways in which you can embed precautions and assurances to make sure that you are along the way doing what's necessary to ensure that the medicines that you're developing are safe and that the benefit outweighs the risk. While not having to get to a point where you are 100% sure, well, you probably never really 100% sure, but being able to look for signals and things that can maybe allow you to approve or conditionally approve a medicine sooner rather than later and allow it to get to patients who really have a critical need and whose disease is progressing and may get to a point, particularly in the rare disease space, where they may be beyond help from a medicine. So getting it to them earlier and then following them ultimately gathering data and providing a full approval at a later point, if you provide a conditional approval early on. So I mean, I think those are a number of things that you can do to kind of help encourage and expedite the development of rare disease medicines.
So it's been well chronicled that biopharmaceutical sponsors, contract research organizations, and even academic medical centers at times struggle to recruit a sufficient number of African Americans for clinical trials. Why do you think that is, and what are some of the things that can be done to help improve that?
If you look at history, I think that will inform a lot of why things are the way that they are with pretty much with anything in life, and it's no different than in drug development. The majority of clinical trials, and historically, were done in academic medical centers, institutions. Those investigators were predominantly white. The patient populations were predominantly white. And that's where all the experience and expertise was developed. There wasn't an emphasis on including diverse populations, or if there was an interest in it, there wasn't a direct action that was tied to it. And so there was always a desire to do it, but not a lot of progress was made on how to achieve it. And so now you have a situation where you have African-American physicians who may have the patient populations that you'd want to include in clinical trials, but they don't have experience as clinical trial investigators. They don't have the infrastructure set up within their practices or hospitals to be able to support running a clinical trial. You need staff, you need systems, and you need training. And they don't have that. So while they may have the patients, they don't necessarily have all the other stuff, all the ancillary things that are needed in order to run a clinical trial. And there's always these competing priorities in the clinical development space between trying to expedite the clinical trial, right? Trying to run it as cost effectively and efficiently as possible. And by its very nature, that kind of means going to people who know how to do this, right? So going to people who have run clinical trials before, who have experience, who you know can recruit patients because they've done it before, and balancing that with you're trying to reach populations you haven't included in your clinical trials, but that means training new investigators, reaching out to centers that may not have been involved in clinical trials, helping them develop the infrastructure, helping to train them, not and then taking a chance, because then not knowing if they're actually going to recruit the patients that you need in the trial, unlike the centers where you've been working for many years and you know that they can recruit and will recruit. So it becomes a delicate balance of trying to figure out, okay, well, how do we do this in a cost-efficient, cost-effective manner so that we're bringing medicines to the market faster for patients who have this need, but also generating the data in different populations so that we know how the drug works in other populations besides just a predominantly white population. So I don't know that I've given you a good answer in terms of how to solve it, but I think I've certainly teed up what the challenges are.
So Henrietta Lacks' lived experience is an important part of that history you briefly highlighted or alluded to. Just recently, the Senate passed a bill to honor her legacy by increasing access to clinical trials and to hopefully help reduce health disparities. I want to give a quick shout out to UCLA. During Nakin and I's freshman year, they offered us the opportunity when we matriculated to read a book. And our book that year was The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. For listeners who don't know, Lacks was an African-American woman who was unwittingly the source of the first immortalized human cell line used for medical research.
I'm glad you guys read that book. I haven't read it. I need to. It is on my list of books to read. To my knowledge, certainly in the areas that we're involved in, we have not used HeLa cell lines. A lot of the work that we do within rare disease is focused on recombinant DNA technology or gene therapy using adeno-associated virus. So I'm not familiar with HeLa cell lines in rare disease, at least in the areas in which we've been focused. The story of Henrietta Lacks is an important one and speaks to a lot of the challenges around healthcare disparities and health equity that are manifest in multiple ways throughout, I think, our healthcare system.
If we look at who's dying of COVID-19 now, the broader discussion on equality, which has jumped to the front of the line with recent events last year, what steps were taken to ensure equitable distribution of the vaccine, maybe? What did Pfizer do externally? And then if you look internally within the firm, what is Pfizer doing to improve DEI efforts internally?
I will say that because of some of the work that we've done in minority populations, they have reached out to us, and you know, I've helped to facilitate at least engagement with our chief patient officer. And they've done some engagements around vaccine confidence with various organizations in the African American community. But again, I can't really speak to that in detail because it's not an area that I've been really working in. In terms of DEI in general, I mean, I will say that if Pfizer has done a lot in this area, and certainly the conversations around diversity and equity have increased in the past year. I've had a number of colleagues reach out to me personally to just have a conversation, a one-on-one, and to ask me, particularly right after the events surrounding George Floyd's death, and check in with me, to see how I was doing, and two, to really have a dialogue with me around race and diversity. One of Pfizer's values, one of our core values is equity. And it was a core value before the events of last year. So equity has always been kind of a focus of Pfizer. I think the events of last year crystallized it a lot and made us pay even more attention to it and made us ask ourselves if we were being intentional enough as an organization to ensure that we were building a diverse and equitable company. And it has certainly prompted actions to increase the diversity of our applicant pool, to make sure that we are creating a space for qualified, diverse candidates to move up in the organization. I mean, Pfizer is probably fairly typical of many companies where the higher you go, the fewer diverse colleagues you have. And so trying to be more intentional about that, ensuring that when there are good, qualified, diverse candidates, that we are giving them the opportunity to rise in the organization, and to be more intentional about that has been a focus, but even more so with the events of last year. And I think Pfizer has really kind of doubled down on it since 2020.
So you've spent, and correct me if I get this wrong, 17 years at Pfizer. So, and for people of my and Pranav's age, you know, the average millennial doesn't spend more than a couple of years at a company at any time, and then moves on to somewhere else. So we're curious kind of what has kept you there so long, and maybe what still excites you about the work you're doing?
So great question. I will start by saying that I love Pfizer, and which is why I've been there for 17 years. And it wasn't a given, because you know, in medical school, I'm actually as surprised as you are that I've been at Pfizer for 17 years. You know, in medical school, they drill into you that the pharmaceutical industry is the dark side, right? The evil empire. I mean, I heard that throughout medical school and residency. No self-respecting physician would ever work for a pharmaceutical company. And when I joined Pfizer, it was a big hurdle that I had to overcome mentally and emotionally in order to join Pfizer. And I joined because I had, you know, I had recently moved to New York, and Pfizer is based in New York. They were in the process of developing a drug in HIV, and you know, my career in practice had been in HIV, and you know, so the opportunity to work in HIV was really appealing to me. And you know, honestly, it was really kind of, I think, the perfect storm, you know, right place, right time, coming to Pfizer, because I wasn't looking to join a pharmaceutical company. But I was looking for a new type of opportunity in my professional development. And if it hadn't been Pfizer, I mean, so in a pharmaceutical company not located in New York where I was, if it hadn't been in HIV, an area that I was passionate about, I don't know that I would have joined. But because those things came together, I was open to this opportunity. I joined Pfizer, and I've never looked back. It's been a tremendous 17 years with the company. And I think because all of the preconceptions or misconceptions I had about working in the industry proved to be just that. They were misconceptions that, you know, I started working at Pfizer, and I found that people were actually really committed to patients and to doing what was in the best interest of patients, and wanting to bring medicines to a market that made a difference in the lives of patients, and that people had a lot of integrity. And I found it just a really great work environment. I felt like we were doing something important. I enjoyed the people that I worked with. And on a personal and professional level, Pfizer gave me an opportunity to grow tremendously. I mean, I've been at Pfizer for 17 years, and I've had, I think, maybe 7 different positions during that time. So I've had the ability over those 17 years to continually learn new things, to continually grow, to continually take on new responsibilities and grow as a leader and as a person. So it's really been a tremendous journey.
So I think you talked about it as being kind of this dark side from medical school. So we want to take you back to that time. So as you were going through undergrad, what inspired you to pursue medicine when you were getting started, and what led you to UCLA?
My journey to medical school and to UCLA is a mix of intentionality and serendipity. So I come from a family of doctors. My father was a physician. In fact, he was he started in practice in 1952 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and was the third African American physician in Baton Rouge. And my sister's also a physician. But growing up in Baton Rouge, when I was a teenager, I used to work in his office during the summers. His receptionist slash nurse would go out on vacation for 2 weeks during the summer, and I would, work in his office. And so I got to see up close and personal what it was to take care of patients. And I mean, he worked in, he was a solo practitioner in a office in, poor section of African-American section of Baton Rouge. And he was very patient focused. And he taught me what it meant to be kind of patient centric. His practice, he didn't take appointments because he knew with his patient population that, when they needed to see a doctor, they needed to see a doctor. And they weren't the types of patients that you're going to make an appointment 2 weeks in advance. So he would come into the office, usually get there around 8 or 8:30. I would get there a little bit earlier, like 7:30, to open things up. And when I would get there, there would always be a line of patients that were there already to see him. And, they would have already started a list of, with their names. And some of them getting there as early as 3 or 4 in the morning so that they could be the first to be seen. And usually by the time that I would get there, there'd already be like 60, 70, maybe 80 names on the list. And, wow. He would spend the rest of the day just kind of working through the list. And it was a really intense experience. I mean, but it was great. And, and I got to see really up close what it was like to be a physician. So, I mean, I kind of always knew that I wanted to go into medicine. And, when the time came for me to begin looking at schools, let me back up for a second. So I was an English major in college. I went to Tulane in New Orleans, so 60, 70 miles away from Baton Rouge. And so you have to understand that, I was still in the closet at the time, and thinking that going to New Orleans would be a way for me to get away from home, to be able to come out and be open about my sexuality. And while I was in college, I get to New Orleans, and for whatever reason, I guess it didn't occur to me when I was thinking about going to college, New Orleans is only 60 or 70 miles away from Baton Rouge, and you have lots of family in New Orleans. So I get there and I don't really feel comfortable coming out and expressing my sexuality. So the summer after my junior year of college, I spent that summer in Europe. I took this course in Victorian literature at the University of London. And while I was there, I met this guy who was on another summer program there, and he was staying in the same dorm that I was, and we became friends, and he was gay, was an undergraduate at UCLA, and so we kept in touch after we came back from Europe, and I was applying for medical schools, and honestly, I UCLA was not even a school I had even considered. I mean, I had my sights set on going to Harvard for medical school. That's really where I wanted to go. And, you know, we're talking on the phone. We were writing letters back and forth. We didn't, since 1981, 82, we didn't have email then. So we're, you know, talking, and he said, you know, you should apply to UCLA. And I really hadn't considered it. And I thought, well, you know, I've never been to LA. This would be a way to get a free trip to go. And, you know, why not? So I applied to UCLA. I got an interview. And this is how, kind of the serendipity part. You know, so I fly out, I spend the weekend in Los Angeles, and I was just blown away by the openness of the city. And I realized, okay, now I could be 2,500 miles away from home. And maybe I could be who I am, who I'm meant to be. And UCLA all of a sudden went from not being a consideration to really being my top choice. And to the point that I actually, I got accepted to Harvard, and I turned them down and decided to go to UCLA. And I mean, again, it was ended up being a great decision. I loved my experience at UCLA. It was a great medical school. I learned a lot. I made some really good friends, and it was a tremendous experience. And, you know, it allowed me to not only get the training that I needed to become a physician, but also to then ultimately come out.
So as you were kind of finishing up your medical degree, you also ended up going back to school to get your MPH as well at UCLA. What kind of brought you back to the classroom after, you know, finishing your residency in medical school?
When I finished my residency, or as I was finishing my residency, I did my residency in school medicine at Cedars-Sinai. As I was finishing my residency in internal medicine, I was asking myself, okay, what is it that I want to do? And I knew that I didn't want to practice general internal medicine, which to me just didn't seem very interesting. At the same time, I didn't want to do a subspecialty. So I really was not looking to do another 2 years in infectious disease or endocrinology or hematology, oncology, anything like that. And so I was looking around for opportunities, and there was a fellowship in health services research in the Division of General Internal Medicine back at UCLA, which to me was very interesting. It was an opportunity to do research that was really more focused, because I'm not a bench researcher. I don't really like the lab. It was just never really my thing. Health services research, though, you know, research that was really kind of more public health focused, access to care, cost of care, you know, outcomes, those types of issues, I found intriguing. And so I, you know, applied for this fellowship and got it. And as part of the fellowship, I also got my master's in public health in the UCLA School of Public Health. And you spent 2 years in this fellowship and doing research I was focused on access to care for HIV positive individuals and the impact of access on outcomes. So that was kind of, you know, how I decided to focus my career after residency. And I really had intended to stay in academic medicine and, you know, just continue doing health services research. But, you know, plans often change and things happen, and, you know, you make new plans.
Or looking back at the time you spent at your dad's solo practice, how much of that do you think was an influence? Because it sounds like seeing those lines of individuals, you know, 70 to 80 people lining up since 3 to 4 a.m., that's probably going to give you a more holistic view of wanting to solve the access component or the general public health, and less of, hey, I want to be a general practitioner and kind of have this daily burnout?
I mean, I think what I learned from my father's practice was just the importance of listening to patients. I mean, I think I've always, maybe it's because of, you know, my father and my parents, I've always kind of had this caregiving component to my personality, and I always wanted to be a caregiver. And I think really seeing it up close with my father is what made me want to go into medicine, and certainly seeing the challenges of his practice highlighted some of the issues around access. I don't know if that was as prominent in my mind, though, as really the patient care piece. I mean, that was what really struck me about watching my father work, and the way that he cared for his patients and took time to talk to them and listen to their needs and hear what they had to say. I mean, that was what was most impressive to me. I think what kind of drove me the most.
So after 8 years of working in private practice, working with HIV positive patients, you ended up deciding to go to law school in what I would call a career pivot of sorts, and not just any law school, Harvard Law School. So what kind of led you to this change? And when you were attending law school, did you have, you know, a specific purpose or goal in mind? Because I don't know too many doctors that also have law degrees. So.
I did have a purpose in mind. It ended up changing, but, you know, maybe just to explain my thought process at the time. I mean, so I ended up, you know, I was all set to do an academic career, and I ended up actually deciding not to do that and to leave academic medicine to go into private practice and to take care of HIV positive patients. And I did that because I really wanted to be able to look back on my time as a physician and, you know, when the AIDS epidemic was behind us, and say that I've been down there in the trenches because this was my community. And so that's really what kind of drove me to leave academic medicine and to go into private practice. And I did that for 8 years and loved taking care of HIV positive patients, and I felt I was making a difference, the kind of difference that I felt my father made when he was in practice. But things changed in HIV. Patients got better. We, you know, got better therapies. And my practice was evolving. And as patients were coming in less and less because they had less and less challenges with managing their HIV, my practice was becoming more and more general internal medicine, which was what I didn't want to do in the first place. So I was kind of at a crossroads, and I had to assess, you know, well, what is next? And so then I kind of fell back to the idea around the issues of access to care and health services. And I was thinking maybe I would get involved in healthcare policy. And so that was really what prompted my decision to go to law school. I thought, you know, I've got an MD, master's in public health, this training in health services research, you know, doing research on access to care issues. If I had a law degree, that could be a really nice, attractive package for getting into healthcare policy. So that was why I decided to go to law school, and, you know, ended up at Harvard. Spent 3 years there, and I mean, again, it was a great experience. But after I finished, I decided that healthcare policy was not what I wanted to do, and you know, ended up moving down to New York, and this opportunity arose with Pfizer.
So I think something that's really interesting is when we look back at your degrees, you have a BA in English with a stint studying Victorian literature in Europe, an MD, a JD, and an MPH. Maybe how have those four kind of various degrees assisted you in different ways throughout your career, maybe even in your current role? And it doesn't have to be something as explicit as quoting Jane Austen or...
Well, that's good, because I couldn't quote Jane Austen. So the BA in English, taught me about the human condition, because that's what literature is about, right? It's about understanding the human condition. And most of medicine, I have found, is about listening and understanding people. As interesting as the science is, I don't think the science alone is what, I know the science alone isn't what motivates me about medicine. It's really the humanistic piece of it. And so I think that the bachelor's in English, you know, kind of highlights that humanistic approach. The medical degree, I mean, I needed it to take care of patients and, you know, to really fulfill that calling that I had to make a difference in the lives of patients. And I think that the master's in public health, you know, has kind of given me that broader perspective around population health and issues of health disparity and health equity and access issues, and has given me the ability to think more broadly about healthcare and the dynamics of our healthcare system and some of its challenges. And, you know, and then finally, the law degree has honed my analytic thinking skills. It has helped me learn how to look at both sides of an issue, because if you're going to advocate for a position, you need to be able to understand and to argue the opposite position, right? Because then you can most effectively advocate for your position if you understand all the arguments on the other side. And it has really helped me to be able to do that, to really think about an issue and to understand both perspectives. Sometimes I think that can kind of lead to indecision, unfortunately, because you can see both sides of an issue, which is a good thing and a bad thing when you're trying to make a decision. Or it can be a good thing or a bad thing.
So one of the other things we wanted to ask about is you currently serve as the co-chair on Sage's board of directors. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what Sage is and why the work they do is important.
First of all, thank you so much for asking about Sage. Sage is something that I'm very passionate about. It stands for Services and Advocacy for GLBT Elders. It is a nonprofit national organization that is focused on providing advocacy and services for LGBT elders. And I mean, Sage, you know, at its core envisions an equitable world, you know, where LGBT elders can live and thrive to the fullest extent possible. And yeah, I've been on the board for 8 years. I had a 6-year stint, and then I took a mandatory year off, and then I rejoined the board about a year and a half ago. And I served for co-chair during the last 2 years of my first 6 years on the board, and now was in my second term as co-chair. And it's a great organization. And like I wrote down a couple of statistics, and I just want to share them with you because I think, you know, it'll highlight why I think this work is so important. So 34% of all LGBT plus elders fear having to go back in the closet when seeking senior housing. 48% of all LGBT couples experience adverse treatment when seeking senior housing. And nearly 60% of all LGBT older adults report feeling a lack of companionship, with more than 50% reporting feeling isolated from others. I mean, so those statistics really struck me. And I'll tell you, when I first got involved with Sage, I got involved because of that first statistic that I quoted to you around that 34% of people feeling that they have to go back into the closet when looking for senior housing. And when I heard that, I thought, how sad that somebody who has lived their entire adult life as a proud, out, open individual now as they reach the end of their life, has to go back into the closet. It just didn't seem right or fair. And I wanted to, you know, do what I could to make sure that that isn't the case for people.
Awesome. And I think that's really inspiring. You found a cause that's, you know, you have a personal interest in and you're working to help. So, and then our final two questions that we like to ask all of our guests.
Okay.
What is your favorite UCLA memory and who is your favorite Bruin?
So in terms of favorite UCLA memory, I have to say, and it's quite appropriate during March Madness, going to basketball games in Pauley Pavilion. I mean, as you guys know, I mean, Pauley Pavilion, you know, in the south part of the campus, really, really close to the medical school. And so I got to go to a number of games during my time at UCLA. And I mean, it's just an incredible experience. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, I mean, for your listeners who are UCLA graduates, they'll understand. It's Pauley Pavilion. It's just, you know, it's just, you just walk in there and there's just this sense of, you know, astonishment and inspiration. It's just incredible. So going to basketball games at Pauley Pavilion, pretty amazing memory. Favorite Bruin, and man, I know I can't choose John Wooden because obviously it would seem that John Wooden would follow from what I just said. So I won't choose John Wooden. So I'm going to go to another sport. I'm going to go to football. I'm going to choose Troy Aikman because I'm a huge football fan, and I think he had a good solid career at UCLA, but he had an incredible career in the NFL, and you know, now as a broadcaster, and he kind of exemplifies how you can recreate yourself, you know, during your life and, you know, along your professional journey. So I'll go with Troy Aikman.
That's a fitting example. Thanks so much for joining us on Bruin One Ear, Not the Other. But before we let you go, feel free to give us a 30-second plug for something going on in your life.
So I'm going to give you some breaking news, because it would feel weird not to share this. So by the time this broadcast is available, this podcast is available, I'll actually be in a new job. So I was recently promoted, actually as of 2 days ago, Friday, I found out. So I'm going to be moving into a new position in the next few weeks, where I'll be leading our Pfizer's internal medicine organization, medical affairs organization, as the chief medical officer. So basically doing, you know, kind of the same job, but with our primary care business, so focused more on cardiology, pain, other areas that are more indicative of more applicable to a larger populations of patients. So we spent a lot of time talking about rare disease, and I've spent the last 5 years in rare disease, but I'm actually going to be moving on to a new and exciting adventure in the next few weeks.
Thanks again to Dr. Kevin Williams for joining us on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to us with any questions, comments, or guest recommendations. As always, hopefully everything we talked about didn't go ruin one ear and out the other.